Happy Halloween. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, October 31st, 2019 on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media for the University of Arkansas. Ahead, we celebrate Halloween. Antoinette Grajeda brings us a report about a class dedicated to the American ghost story. The class traveled to the 1886 Crescent Hotel in Eureka to examine the history of spooky stories there. And our militant grammarian, Catherine Sherrills, is with us for a special Halloween visit. After our show on Here and Now, the latest news from the impeachment inquiry in Washington, the wildfires in California, and continued coverage of Brexit from London, where Jeremy Hobson visits his 93-year-old British grandmother to hear her view of UK politics. Here and Now, beginning at 1 today, and stay with us throughout the day for the latest updates on what happens in Congress and reaction from the White House. A Halloween classic performed tonight at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. Northwest Arkansas Audio Theater will create the infamous War of the Worlds broadcast from 1938. Orson Welles' radio version of H.G. Wells' science fiction thriller created panic for some who didn't realize the broadcast was a mere play. Tonight's performance begins at 8:30. Find out more at acozarks.org. This is Ozarks at Large. Fort Smith is the second largest city in Arkansas, and some city leaders believe it's time to establish a city-owned city hall instead of continuing to keep offices in a leased space downtown. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with City Administrator Carl Gefkin about where that project stands.
For people who've never been to Fort Smith or never had to do business with the city of Fort Smith, can you describe what the current city offices look like downtown?
Well, the majority of the city employees, especially in administration and engineering and such, work in a building that's owned by Stevens Productions at the corner of 7th and Garrison. And the city has had offices here for several decades. However, as all cities have grown to try to meet the needs of their residents, we're outgrowing this building. And so we have people that are tucked away in what could be considered closets in small areas. And in order to be able to provide the services we should be providing, we need a centralized city hall where it makes it easier for residents to walk around and get the services they ask for.
Why doesn't Fort Smith have a city hall?
That's a very good question, and I'm not aware of the reason why, though I would think it would have been primarily due to the fact that we have a very good lease with Stevens Productions, and they're a very good landlord, and so instead of spending the money to build a building, why not have a lease and be right on Garrison Avenue.
Can you tell us what kind of properties you're looking at? Are you looking to build a new building? Are you looking to repurpose a building that already exists?
Well, we're looking at several locations throughout the city currently, preferably bricks and mortar that are already here, in order to save the city money and not necessarily have to build. It's better to be able to buy something that's currently here and repurpose it. But we're going to need to keep the specific locations a little bit quiet for now. We're looking at several locations. We are looking downtown because we are downtown. And I know so many of our residents are accustomed to coming downtown. And it's a great boon for the downtown area to have the number of employees we have at 623 Garrison, but we're also looking in other locations just to make sure that we can compare the buildings and the locations to see what would best suit the needs of the city in having a city hall at the most inexpensive cost to the city and one that also would open up access to our residents to be able to access City Hall. Those are three very difficult goals to try to maximize, but that's what we're looking to do.
Any idea at this point how much it would cost to establish a city hall?
We're on a cost expedition at the moment. That's why we're looking at specific buildings. We do know and have been looking at the upper threshold of having 60,000 square feet at to build and outfit at 300 a square foot. So that's 18 million. But we do not want to go anywhere near that number, especially since there are buildings already here in the city that are looking to be repurposed and that will fit our needs.
Is any money budgeted for this kind of project at this point?
The money is not budgeted at this point, but that's why we're looking at the buildings, at current buildings that can be repurposed and renovated if need be, in a cost-efficient manner. And then we'll look at the means by which the city can or cannot afford it. But it's kind of the chicken and egg approach. We have to go out and start looking at buildings to find the cost and at the same point in time realize the constraints we have on our available funds. So we frankly spend as little as possible.
Why go looking for a city hall now? Is there anything in particular that's driving this decision?
That's a great question, because when I came here, one of the issues that was brought to my attention by the board when I was interviewed was that we don't have a city hall, and that the city did try back in 2000, 2001 with a bond issue, and it was rejected. But there's always been a request and a thought that Fort Smith, as the second largest city in Arkansas, should have its own city hall. And that's what prompted me to start looking and start examining the possibility. And then also recently, when we've been looking to expand services to handle things such as business licenses and our internal auditor's department, to have that properly sized and staffed, we just don't have the room in this building. And we're looking to reconfigure some of the space. And the first time we looked to reconfigure that space, it was going to be very expensive. And I mean, to be frank, I did not necessarily want to spend that much money or a lot of money on a building that the city doesn't own.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Fort Smith City Administrator Carl Gefkin speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek. Gefkin says there's no timeline for when the city might have a city hall. Much will depend on the space ultimately chosen and how much that space will cost.
Thaden School is now accepting applications for students entering grades 6 through 12 during the 2020-21 academic year. Located in downtown Bentonville, Thaden educates students from across Northwest Arkansas. Apply online or learn more at thadenschool.org. Walton Arts Center's 10x10 Arts Series presents The Nature of Forgetting, Tuesday, November 5th at 7 p.m. This theater piece uses art and science to tell the story of a middle-aged father in the early stages of dementia. His journey through memory loss shows us that broken does not always mean defeated. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets and information.
A strike by teachers in the Little Rock School District, the state's largest, is looking more likely as a contract expires today between the district and the teachers' union there. The State Board of Education voted this month to no longer recognize the Little Rock Education Association as the district's sole bargaining agent. Mayor Frank Scott Jr. says preparations are in place.
We stand ready and prepared that if there's a teacher strike, that we take care of our students, that they have somewhere to go. We want to ensure that our students are safe throughout this process, and we continue to advocate for our teachers in our conversations with the governor and the Arkansas Department of Education.
Meanwhile, a spokesperson for the district estimates that about a quarter of the 23,000 students took part in a sick out yesterday as a show of solidarity with teachers. It comes as the State Board of Education is to consider a plan for how to return local control to the district. It's been under state control for 4 years because of a large number of failing schools.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. On today's show, we will hear from University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj, who says that the tariff war started by President Donald Trump is not impacting China as much as other factors are. Plus, details of a new hotel opening this week in Rogers, and some big news to report from Fayetteville startup Linnaeus Medical. That's all ahead today on this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Stick around after the break. We'll be right back.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. Local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
University of Arkansas economist Mervin Jebaraj says China's economy has been growing slowly for the better part of a decade. And the tariff war started by President Donald Trump is not impacting the country as much as other factors are. Appearing on a recent episode of Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock, Jebaraj said 2010 was the last peak year for growth that China showed when it used to average 10 to 12% growth each year. Since then, annual growth has been sliding downward to around 6%.
So I think if you were to read just some headlines, you might get that notion that the Chinese economy is being pummeled by the current trade wars. But if you take a longer-term view, you'd see that the Chinese economy has been on a downward trajectory. It's been growing slowly since about 2010. That was the last peak growth rate they've had. And since then, you know, the annual growth rate in China has tended to go down. And that was expected by everybody around the world since it started happening in 2010, because the Chinese economy used to grow at 10, 12% year over year. And that is a rate that cannot be sustained by a maturing economy. As the economy matures, it tends to grow more slowly. And you tend to have growth rates like you see in more developed economies. So China's not quite there yet to be a developed economy, looking at 2 to 3% growth on average. They're still maturing, but they're a lot more mature than where they used to be 10, 20, and 30 years ago, when the Chinese economy first was a full participant in the global economy and were growing in double-digit rates. So yes, this is the slowest growth they've recorded since about early 1990s, but that downward trajectory started in 2010. It didn't start this year, it didn't start last year, and it didn't start the year before. So the trade wars have slowed the Chinese economy down, but that's not the reason why you see these headlines for the Chinese economy slowing. That's just, you know, where the trend has taken them over a long period of time. So the Chinese economy has some long-term growth issues outside of the trade war and the short-term impact that it's having right now. Some of that has to do with the debt load of the companies in China and local governments in China. And the other major important factor in China is that their workforce is aging. And some of the hangover effects of the one-child policy that they've had in place for many years means that there isn't a lot of young people coming in to replace that workforce. So that means over the long term, over the next several years, China is going to have a much bigger problem replacing their labor force than they do right now. And I think that is a much larger an important concern for the Chinese economy than what's going on with the trade wars right now.
But are the trade wars having any impact on China? Can you see an acceleration or anything in the Chinese economy from the tariffs?
I mean, I think if you looked at the trend line of Chinese economic growth, it's been pointing down since 2010, and it's hard to say that there has been any large acceleration that happened since the trade war began last year in 2018. So it's very hard to pinpoint. Obviously, Chinese exports to the United States are down, but at the same time, we're starting to see Chinese exports to other countries go up. So it's not entirely clear that they've had a huge hit. Of course, it has affected them, probably more than it's affected the United States economy, but it's not possible to say that the Chinese economy has been pummeled by any means by the trade war.
Jebaraj also discussed Governor Asa Hutchinson's recent trade trip to India and the Middle East and the potential for new markets for foreign direct investment in the state.
When you look at the Chinese economy and whether or not they'll continue to grow at the pace that you've seen, so they grew about 6% in the most recent reading, which is the slowest it's been. But there aren't very many other countries around the world that have the sort of manufacturing base that China has had and the ability to have that level of foreign direct investment in other countries to the level that we've seen, for example, around the United States and here in Arkansas, where we've seen several billion-dollar deals from Chinese companies trying to set up manufacturing bases around here in Arkansas and other parts of the United States. So could we replace that level of foreign direct investment from China? There is not another country out there that can provide that level of foreign direct investment, so it's about, you know, adding up a bunch of different countries to try to see if we can get there. So India obviously contributes to that. We have a little bit of business from India here in the United States and in Arkansas. UAE could be a new market, but the thing to remember is that when we talk about a global economic slowdown, it is actually truly global. The Chinese economy is slowing, so is the Indian economy, and so is the economy in the United Arab Emirates. So while these new relationships and building new relationships is important to diversify where we might get some foreign direct investment from, it's important to note that we may not actually see those benefits in the short run because all of those economies are slowing as well.
And that is economist Mervin Jebaraj, who's the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas. You can watch that full interview on our sister website at talkbusiness.net. Earlier this week online, we reported details of a new hotel just north of Pinnacle Hills Promenade in Rogers. It is called Courtyard by Marriott Bentonville Rogers, and it opened for travelers on Monday. Springdale-based Krushiker Hospitality Group is the owner and manager of the 122-room property. Laura Orr is the general manager. Some of the amenities include an outdoor swimming pool, fitness center, business center, and a casual dining restaurant called the Bistro. And from the region's startup scene, healthcare startup Linnaeus Medical of Fayetteville is one of just 10 companies who've been chosen for the inaugural class of the Digital Health CT Accelerator. The program is based in Hartford, Connecticut. It begins November 12th and will run for 3 months, concluding in February 2020 with a demo day. Linnaeus Medical was one of nearly 400 applicants vying for the initial cohort of 10 companies. Linnaeus Medical has developed a unique patented breakaway IV technology that is being designed to work with a variety of medical tubing. The company's first product, SafeBreak Vascular, fits into any standard IV tubing and will help prevent IV lines from failing. Those are just some of the headlines we reported this week at nwabusinessjournal.com, where you will find reporting on the latest business news each and every day. And that's all for this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and I am joined now by Leah Uribe, an associate professor of music at the University of Arkansas. Welcome back.
Hi, Antoinette. How are you doing today?
Doing well. How about you?
I'm doing great. Excited about this week and the weather and the beautiful colors in Fayetteville and the area. So I have some interesting concerts for this upcoming week to talk about. As I was driving here this morning, I was thinking how cool it is to have these, organizations and people that are sort of forethinking, trying to change the dynamics of music in our area. So the first one I wanted to talk about is APO, Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra, which, you know, has been around for a long time. But this year, they're trying something different. They are redesigning their center of attention and trying to bring performances to different stages, different places. They have been making alliances and collaborating with places like Crystal Bridges, The Record Downtown in Bentonville, The Momentary, Bike Rike Brewery and restaurants and such. Just, in this effort to take in classical music out of the concert hall and allowing, for this music to be enjoyed by all and in a maybe less threatening environment. So the first concert of this season for them will be at the Record downtown in Bentonville. And the title of this concert is Gaiety, Glitz, and Glamour, Music from the Silver Age of Stage and Screen. So the conductor, Maestro Stephen Bias, has put together a list of really amazing music that is, you know, if people that go to the movies and people that like the classics are going to have a great time just recognizing those masterpieces by composers like Irving Berlin and George Gershwin and many others. This is going to happen on Monday, November the 4th at 6:30 p.m., and tickets are $35 and $40. Now, something really cool about APO is that they want to make all of these concerts family-friendly. So they have been collaborating with the music department, the University of Arkansas, to bring some of our music education students.
Oh, cool.
So while adults are enjoying the concert, kids are with our music students having some music activities.
Oh, that's
so
fun.
So I just wanted to put that out there because it's convenient for parents. And, of course, kids can listen to the music as well, but they have options. The other concert that I am super excited about, I mean, this is an organization and a person that has been around for a long time, Katie Hendrickson and the Trillium Salon Series.
Yes.
I love Katie and I miss Katie over here, but she's doing amazing things. And one of them is making sure to, as she says it in her webpage, she's redefining the live music experience for classical, new, and experimental sounds. Trillium Salon Series started some time ago, and it was the idea of taking music to you. So on Tuesday, November the 5th, this is a living room concert. She's bringing the Ezra Duo. This is viola and piano music, a Canadian duo of young musicians that you know seems to be very, they seem to be very decorated with the competitions, and you know they have been touring all around Canada and the United States. They will be presenting a program that includes also a really interesting set of composers, Rebecca Clark, that has been around, beautiful writing for viola, and Mary Kuyum-Jan, new music, new composers, women composers, along with traditional pieces for viola and piano by Brahms and Prokofiev. So this is going to be an amazing experience. Doors open at 6 p.m. The concert starts at 6:30 p.m., Tuesday, November 5th, but this is the deal. We have a link in our Authors at Large webpage that will link you to the Trillium Salon Series webpage. If you want to know where this concert is, you have to RSVP.
Mm-hmm. Living rooms are small.
Probably so. And also, I like that commitment. You go there, you commit to go, and then you get an address. It's that surprise element. It's going to be really fun. So that's another cool concert happening this week. I also want to briefly invite everybody to the many events that are happening at the University of Arkansas. We have a myriad of concerts starting on Thursday, October 31st, all the way to Wednesday, November 6th. Pretty much every evening something is happening, studio recitals, student recitals. So I invite everybody to go there. Those concerts are free and open to the public. And it's great for us to have your support, for you to come and see what our students are doing, and for our students to start building an audience of people that are, you know, music lovers and really interested in supporting this tradition of classical music.
And people can always find out what's happening at the university at music.uark.edu.
That's right.
Lots going on. As always, thank you so much for sharing.
It is. Thank you so much, and I will see you guys around.
Leah Uribe is an associate professor of music at the University of Arkansas.
The third annual Mount Sequoia Smartathon is Tuesday, November 12th from 5:30 until 8:30 p.m. This fundraiser is a team trivia competition complete with food, drink, a silent auction, and prizes to trivia winners. Team registration, individual tickets, and more information available at mountsequoia.org/events. Walton Arts Center's Laugh Out Loud series presents humorist David Sedaris Sunday, November 3rd at 7 p.m. Sedaris has charmed audiences with his neurotic and mundane yet profound storytelling, essays, and national public radio segments for more than 25 years. Tickets and information available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600.
This is Ozarks at Large. This November, several outlets across the country are collaborating with organizers of the Purple Project for Democracy, a nonpartisan campaign to rediscover and recommit to democracy. Throughout November, Ozarks at Large and KUAF will be participating, exploring civics, government, and public service. Before tomorrow's official launch, we wanted a primer on the project. We reached Rebecca Winthrop, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution. She says a growing polarization is one reason for the Purple Project for Democracy, but certainly not the only inspiration.
We've had divisive politics in our country for, you know, ever since the United States was founded. But what we were especially worried about was this idea that at least almost one in three people in America, especially young people, don't necessarily think that a democratic form of government or democracy is that important for the United States and would be willing to consider a strong leader, aka a dictator or army rule. And to us, that was the most concerning. Sort of the belief in the foundations of our whole system of government, irregardless of what political debates are winning the day.
One in three is an incredibly scary statistic.
It is a scary statistic. It's almost one in three. It's from a Democracy Fund survey. And there's been a lot of debate about why that is. And some talk about the decline of civic education in schools. And it's true that civic education isn't given as much prominence in most states as it used to be. There's a lot of civics, social studies teachers, civics education teachers who also have to do second teaching jobs in a school, so coaching a sports team. About 37% of social studies teacher coach sports teams compared to 15% of English teachers. So they're kind of the bottom rung of the totem pole in some ways, not because they're not important, but because other subjects have been emphasized. I don't think you can put all the blame on the school system by any means. I also think that for a lot of young people, you know, they haven't seen, at least at a national level, democracy working very well. Things aren't getting done very efficiently, and that might be part of it.
So what can the partners do that are involved in the project to, I don't know, better educate or better inspire passion about democracy?
Yeah, I think our number one message of the Purple Project and the We the Purple Project is to really say, yes, our country has problems, but it is still a great country. We need not to discard democracy as a result of seeing all our problems, but rather double down on democracy and participate more. And we really say, look, everybody talks about voting. It's incredibly important, but it's just merely the first step to really being an engaged citizen. And we want a robust engaged citizenry across the country in every state, rural and urban. And we've come up with five urgent things that we would say are key to be an involved citizen. And one is for sure, stay informed. And to me, if I would have to say just do one thing, I would say that. I would say subscribe to a newspaper or a news station. There's a great organization called All Sides, which basically presents the news and the sort of spectrum of the news from conservative to central to liberal. And I would say, look at the different, get out of your filter bubbles and look at the different perspectives and focus in on probably the more fact-based centrist perspectives would be my recommendation. There's a bunch of other things to do too, like helping others and, you know, participating politically, et cetera.
I know that part of the idea to get as many people exposed to this as possible is to be across that spectrum and across a fractured media with these messages or with these ideas, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we really believe, and I really believe this, that, you know, we as Americans actually are much better than a lot of our headlines say that we are, in terms of, I think if you talk to people from conservative communities and if you talk to people from liberal communities, they actually do agree on quite a bit. I grew up in Southern Oregon. It's a very healthy mix of Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, there's a lot that I think people can agree on. And when you talk to people about, you know, really what is at stake if you would not live in a democracy, I think a lot of people agree that we definitely want a balance of powers. We want a strong legislative branch. We want Congress, which is sort of the most important branch and represents the people, to do its job, you know, as well as the other branches. And it would be scary to live in a country where things are, you know, really out of whack, or you know, you have an authoritarian leader that's not checked by the legislative branch.
Gosh, I think some people are going to be listening to this conversation and say, well, wait, doesn't everyone want strong checks and balances? I mean, I think this is going to be hard for some people to realize that there are a significant number of people that aren't aware of the, not just advantages, but the necessities of some of these basic tenets of democracy.
Yeah, and I think part of our effort and why we really teamed up with all our fabulous partners, again, largely from the private sector, largely from the, you know, media marketing, public communications, PR world, which is so creative and so good at selling things and ideas to the American people, but has rarely partnered with the kind of civic engagement, civic education groups that are existing across the country for many years, is that people need to be resold the idea of what is core to democracy and why is it so important. And I have to say, personally, from I've done most of my work in my career overseas on rebuilding societies in post-conflict countries. So I have definitely seen up close and personal what it means when you don't have a strong Congress or legislature, that which is the direct voice of the people, that can actually, you know, check and hold accountable, you know, a leader with authoritarian, autocratic tendencies. It's very scary, and it never ends well, I have to say. We definitely do not want to go on that route.
What would you say to someone who heard your last comment and said, well, there's no way we're going to go down that route. Come on. We've been around for 200-plus years, and we've had strife before, but we always right the ship.
Yeah, I believe we will right the ship. I believe, actually, so much more when I talk to individual people, when I talk to my family members, which sit on both sides of the aisle, so much more binds us together as a country, as individuals, as communities, and separates us. But what I'm worried about is I see the type of deep partisan divide, but just really social divide almost, that is getting more and more people are moving to the extremes. And I've seen that in societies as kind of a warning sign in other countries where people cannot come together and agree on at least the fundamentals of how their system of government should run. So I do believe we'll right the ship, but I have to say I see a lot of similar signs to places I've worked overseas. And the only thing I would say to people who say, no, come on, we can't compare ourselves to that, really, truly, it's happened in other countries. It's happened in other countries that were prosperous, that had great education systems, that, you know, were enfranchising all sorts of members of their society. And it can happen here. And really, the only thing that stands between us and that type of a fate is ourselves, is citizens taking this seriously and really actively engaging and doing, you know, those five things: staying informed, voting, helping other people in their community, participating in political life, you know, and sharing, getting social and spreading the word about why it's important to be a mindful patriot and support the basic principles of democracy.
Rebecca Winthrop is Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution and an organizer of Purple Project for Democracy, a nonpartisan campaign to rediscover and recommit to democracy. Throughout November, we're exploring civics, government, and public service. Tomorrow, Antoinette Grajeda talks with Jennifer Price, Executive Director of the Washington County Election Commission, and this is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Idle Class magazine presents the 2019 Black Apple Awards Friday, November 15th, 6 p.m. at Theater Squared in Fayetteville. This event is an experience of music, dance, art installations, and more. IdleClassMag.com/BlackApple2019 for tickets and information.
During the Halloween season, people who enjoy being spooked often seek out goosebump-inducing activities like watching horror movies or visiting haunted houses. One of the more popular ghost stories in Northwest Arkansas is that of the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. Built in 1886, the Crescent now offers ghost tours where participants can learn about the hotel's history and its paranormal happenings. Part of that history includes charlatan Norman Baker turning it into a cancer hospital in the late 1930s. Earlier this month, a group from the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, or OLLIE for short, took a tour of the Haunted Hotel. It was an optional field trip as part of their five-week course on the American ghost story. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda tagged along. She brings us this story.
Yes, this is us.
While ghost tours often take place during the night, ours begins in the late morning. Sunny skies provide a clear view of the Ozark Mountains from an observation deck at the top of the hotel. Keith Scales, our guide for the day, says, according to legend, a young woman fell to her death from this spot years ago, but her presence remains.
What has been seen is what looks like a cloud of mist that descends from actually the balcony below this one. Baker put this floor in, and this precedes Baker, so it's from the floor below. This cloud of mist seems to be coming, falling, and it looks like there's a figure of a girl in it and a man standing and turning away from where the mist apparently falls from.
Scales says a crowd often gathers around 10:30 at night in hopes of seeing ghostly activity.
Just to show you how persistent the story is, at one point there was a cop over there in the East Mountain Overlook, was looking in this direction, and he saw what he thought was a jumper, somebody jumping up the balcony, and he called the hotel real quick. And he said, you guys just had a suicide. Somebody just jumped over the balcony. And the front desk clerk looked at the clock and said, 10:30? Oh, that's okay. That's the lady in the mist. She always does that.
As we climb down flights of the hotel's creaky stairs, we pause on different floors to hear stories of more paranormal activities guests have reported in specific rooms. At the end of the tour, participants discuss why they came.
I was hoping to see an apparition because I enjoy that kind of stuff.
Right? So you want to see something?
I want to see something, yeah.
What about the rest of you?
We had always heard about the ghost tours here, and it was just a great opportunity to be able to hear more about it.
Penny Davis says the Crescent Hotel was amazing, and she enjoys ghost stories because the supernatural is something that's fun to explore.
I love mysteries. I like to figure out what is going on, and I like to believe, but I also want to make sure that, like, well, is there a rational basis for this? You know, can it be disproved? And if it can't, then that makes it really kind of fun.
Davis is a student at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Arkansas. The organization provides mature adults with an avenue for lifelong learning by offering a variety of classes like the one focused on ghost stories that Davis is taking.
What else do you notice about the difference between the paranormal and the supernatural?
Things That Go Bump in the Night, the classic American ghost story, is being taught by Ashley Robinson. The class has met every Tuesday in October for 2 hours at the OLLIE office in downtown Fayetteville.
I came up with the idea because I love being spooked in October, and historically I have always taught a spooky literature class for OLLIE. So we've done Sherlock Holmes, we did Dracula, we did Robert Louis Stevenson, so Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So this year I was trying to think of a monster or a topic that we hadn't covered before, and ghosts came to mind.
Jesse Barr and his wife are enrolled in Robinson's class and says they've taken Ollie classes before.
We really enjoy them because it sort of keeps us involved in the world. And also, they really have excellent instructors, like Ashley, for instance. We go to her courses at times, I think, simply because we like to have her around and be with her. So it's fun.
Ross Hooper is another Ollie student and fan of Ashley Robinson. She says one reason people are fascinated with ghost stories is because of our need to have explanations for things.
I think it's kind of the human condition that our brains, I think, are very active, and I think they despise downtime. And so we're always making something up or thinking of something that would explain something that we certainly can't see.
Instructor Ashley Robinson says in her class they're addressing why ghost stories persist and what Americans' obsession with ghosts says about us as a culture.
I think Americans are obsessed with looking forward, and one of the scariest things for us is the past lingering and having to turn around and face the things that have happened in the past. So for the most part, the American ghost story is tied to trauma, whether that is the eradication of indigenous peoples. The haunted Native American burial ground is like, I mean, a textbook American ghost story. We're often afraid to reckon with the things that have happened to us in the past. And that is part of the haunted house narrative, right? Someone died here and they're still here. And how are we going to deal with the fact that this person is maybe still here? I think Americans are afraid of the past because we always want to move forward. And whether it's a real ghost or the ghost of your own history, you have these companions as you move through life. And I think that that's a universal experience, honestly.
She says American ghost stories are similar to European ghost stories because they pull from the Gothic tradition.
So in that sense, no, there's not really anything different formally from what is happening in these stories. What is different are some of the themes. So again, Americans are really concerned with the past and what it means for the present in these stories. Americans really love the psychological trauma of it all. Is it real? Is it not? Am I going crazy? Is the ghost actually there? So the story structurally tends to just follow these Gothic structures that if you've read Frankenstein, you know them. But what the stories end up doing thematically tend to be different.
For this class, students have read mostly fiction as well as excerpts from Colin Dickey's Ghostland,
which is nonfiction, and it's about why America is so obsessed with ghost stories. It's brilliant, and it's the perfect companion to the ghost story because, of course, we all have ghost stories that we love to tell each other.
Sharing those stories, she says, is one thing that helps keep them alive.
One of the things we know about ghost stories scientifically is that when you hear a ghost story, especially a real ghost story, from someone who you trust or who is in a position of authority, your base level of belief goes up a notch. And so in that way, ghost stories tend to be contagious as well.
As the class winds down, Robinson says she hopes her students will find that the course was educational and fun.
My hope is that we can, at the end of this class, students will have a way to understand the ghost stories that are around us, and they'll have a better understanding of what the ghost story means to Americans specifically. And of course, when I say Americans, I mean like people who live in the United States. And the hodgepodge of cultures makes that a really interesting discussion to have. So, and I also hope they take with them some goosebumps. Like as we go into Halloween, I hope that they can share these stories with their loved ones and, you know, spook them a little bit too.
For more information about Ollie's courses, you can visit olli.uark.edu. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The Osher Lifelong Learning Institute is seeking instructors and course proposals for spring 2020. Deadline for submissions today. You can learn more by calling 575-4545.
KUAF is giving away two tickets to see author and humorist David Sedaris at Walton Arts Center November 3rd. Sedaris has charmed audiences with his neurotic and mundane, yet profound storytelling essays, and national public radio segments for more than 25 years. The winner will be announced on Friday, November 1st, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. KUAF.com to register or for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large, and with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Catherine Shurls. How are you, Catherine?
I'm good. Kyle, I love Halloween for the drama and creativity. When the weather is good, I like to find a place on Dixon Street to watch the parade of costumes.
Yep.
Because there's some very weird and wonderful stuff there. There's so many traditions associated with Halloween. Let's look into the origins of some of them. And, of course, I've created a quiz for you.
Fantastic.
I suppose there are people who find the spookiness of Halloween scary. What do you call a fear of Halloween? Is it Wiccaphobia, Samhainaphobia, Nyctophobia, or Plasmophobia?
Well, I can't do any sort of logic here whatsoever. I'm going to go with Wiccaphobia.
Nope.
No.
And the reason you can't is because you, like I, did not know that Halloween can be traced back to Samhain. S-A-M-H-A-I-N.
Did not know that.
It's an ancient Celtic harvest festival honoring the Lord of the Dead.
Okay.
So Samhainophobia is a fear of Halloween. Yeah. Samhain also marked the beginning of the Celtic New Year. Because it was a time of transition between the old and the new, the Celts believed that the souls of those who had died during the previous year traveled together to the land of the dead. And it was also a time when those who had died before returned to visit their homes. Some people disguised themselves in masks and costumes so that the visiting spirits would not recognize them. They didn't want to mess with the dead.
I get you.
The word mask made a trip through French, my mask, from Italian mascara, and perhaps from the Latin masca, meaning evil spirit or witch. Hmm. So that's where witches came.
Okay.
Kyle, what was the observance called before it was the modern day Halloween? Was it All Saints Day or All Souls Day?
Gosh. I'm gonna say it's All Saints Day.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was also called All Hallows Day. It began at sundown on October 31st. The word Halloween is actually a shortened version of All Hallows' Even, the eve of All Hallows' Day. At some point, people began referring to All Hallows' Eve as Halloween. Do you remember Halloween having an apostrophe
I've
in it?
I've seen it.
Yeah, between the W-E and the E-N, and then they dropped the apostrophe. And do you know the collective term for the day before Halloween through 2 days after? This is very, very common these days.
October 30th through November 2nd?
Actually,
That set has?
A collective name.
That's not De Los Muertos. Okay.
Dia de los Muertos. Los Dias.
Okay.
Plural.
Yes.
De Los Muertos.
Yes.
Yeah. This is a time when families fondly remember the deceased and participate in various festivals. By the way, I'm going to New Braunfels, Texas this year to see the Day of the Dead Festival.
Oh, good for you.
Kyle, what are you likely to see a lot of on porches around this time of year?
Jack-o'-lanterns.
Yeah, and when they're made of what?
Pumpkins.
Yeah. What were jack-o'-lanterns carved from before they used pumpkins? Potatoes, turnips, apples, or onions?
But what's big in Ireland? Because going back to the cell, I'm going to say
potatoes are, but no, turnips.
Okay, well.
good logic.
Thank you.
But
thank you.
Didn't work. Jack-o'-lanterns, also jack-a-lanterns, originated in the British Isles with a large turnip or other vegetable rather than a pumpkin. The original meaning of the word jack-o'-lantern was night watchman or man with a lantern. But it took on the Halloween sense in 1837, first in Nathaniel Hawthorne's Twice Told Tales. Irish immigrants brought the jack-o'-lantern custom to North America, where that's when pumpkins were first used.
And, you know, once you get past The Wizard of Oz, one of the main characters in Frank L. Baum's other Oz books is a walking pumpkin-headed jack-o'-lantern.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Which to me has always been so frightening.
Oh, gosh, yes.
What do you think people first used bonfires for?
Oh, boy, this seems like something bad, like burning witches or something.
kind of in the name, bonfire, a little bit. Take bon and add a letter to the end of it.
Bones, yes, a bonfire. I had heard that. Yes, a bonfire.
A bonfire comes from words bone and fire, fire of bones, and originally indicated a large open-air fire on which bones were burnt, either as a ceremony, like a funeral, or for burning heretics or banned books. The Halloween bonfires were lit to scare away evil spirits. Kyle, here's some things we learned from watching scary movies as kids.
Okay.
Where is Transylvania? I've got a
choice.
Well,
there's one in Kentucky, but that doesn't count.
Do you want the choice?
Yes.
Hungary, Scotland, Romania, nowhere. It's made up.
It's either Hungary or Romania, and I think I'm going to go with Romania.
Mm-hmm. That's right. What would be most useful if a werewolf attacked you? A gun with silver bullets, a cross, or to hide out until daylight?
Well, hiding out till daylight is not bad, but if you've got a silver bullet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other two are associated with vampires.
Right.
Yeah.
Although a werewolf is only a werewolf
at
during
night?
The full moon.
Oh, is it? Oh. When do werewolves transform themselves? No. During lunar eclipses, when there's a full moon, or whenever they feel like
full
it?
Full moon.
Yeah, right.
You can think of Lon Chaney Jr., and he's trying to be tied up so he doesn't, when he turns into the werewolf. And what is it, lanthropy? There's a term for becoming a werewolf. I watch a lot of old scary movies.
I think you're ahead of me. Yeah. What Halloween word do you think came from aghast, the root of aghast, struck with terror or shocked, and ghastly?
Oh, I was going to say ghastly until you used it in the definition. A ghost?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The German word for ghost, Geist, is part of the word Zeitgeist.
Huh. How about that?
Which literally means spirit of the time. What do you call a ghost that moves things around your house?
Poltergeist.
Yep. What brought Frankenstein's monster to life?
Well, a bolt of lightning, electricity.
Mm-hmm, lightning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which famous prince was Dracula based on?
Vlad the Impaler.
Vlad the Impaler.
Yes.
And finally, here's a question about another question about Halloween fruits, and this is one I didn't know. Which of these fruits was the focus of Celtic Halloween practices? Cherries, apples, or pumpkins?
I'm going to say apples.
Mm-hmm.
And I only said that because when I was a kid, you bobbed for apples at Halloween carnivals.
Yeah, and that's where it comes from.
Okay.
Because of their association with female deities, apples, and the pentagram shape appearing in their core upon being sliced in half. I've never thought about that as being a pentagram.
Haven't either. That's news to me.
Apples were often the focus of Celtic traditions. Halloween activities like bobbing for apples, drinking apple cider, making candy apples, and handing out apples to trick-or-treaters comes from this Celtic ritual. So have a happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to our militant grammarian, who is Catherine Sherrills.
Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art presents Crystals in Art, Ancient to Today, a new exhibition exploring the connections between crystals and art throughout the world. Artifacts to contemporary art will be on display from ancient Egypt, the Roman Empire, China, and Arkansas. Open now through January 6th. Tickets and information at crystalbridges.org.
And contributors to this Halloween edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda and Zuzanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis mastered our show today from inside the Harold and Blanchcock News Studio. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling is provided through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. And you can find more news about Arkansas business and Arkansas politics at talkbusiness.net. Special thanks to Leah Uribe and Catherine Sherrills, our militant grammarian, for their Thursday contributions as well. And a reminder, we'll officially launch our Purple Project for Democracy Participation on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, when Antoinette Grajeda begins a series of conversations about how elections work with Jennifer Price, the Washington County Election Coordinator. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Rush. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. We're back tomorrow at noon and 7 with a brand new Friday edition of the show. Thanks so much for listening. Be safe tonight.